Annabel Croft first picked up a tennis racket at the age of 9. Within 6 years, she'd become the youngest British player to compete in the Wimbledon main draw for almost a century. At the age of 17, she won both Junior Wimbledon and the Junior Australian Open, and at 18, she was the British number one. Then, aged 21, she retired from tennis and moved into broadcasting. So she was soon back at the world's major tennis tournaments, but this time as a commentator and a reporter. In 2023, her competitive spirit found a new outlet. She took part in Strictly Come Dancing and came fourth. And she's back on stage this autumn, touring the UK with a show reflecting on her career. You brought us music, Annabel, by Pachelbel, Handel, John Rutter. But I think we're going to start with Prokofiev.
Yes, we are. And this is a very strong memory for me. In fact, it's already made my body have a few tingles, because when I was a child, I would say I was about 3 or 4, actually, I started ballet and I absolutely loved it. And my mum took me to see Romeo and Juliet with Margot Fonteyn and Rudolf Nureyev, if that's how you say his name. And I just loved this piece of music. And I used to go back to my bedroom when I was very little and just danced. And I have such strong memories. In fact, even talking about it, I can be there now. So every single time I ever hear this piece of music, I'm still dancing like I was Margot Fonteyn in my bedroom. It's
well,
just amazing.
Well, the studio's a little bit small, but if you want to pirouette,
stop
be my
dancing
guest.
Around in here, exactly.
Thank you.
my body's honestly been going in shivers just listening to that piece of music, because it's got so much depth to it and, you know, that very powerful beginning and quite darkness about it. And I can almost visualise all those costumes and the lighting and the storyline. And then it goes into that sort of more love part and
love
floatiness.
Music, yeah.
And it's got so many different sections to it that it just takes you on this journey. And honestly, I feel quite taken aback listening to it again, actually. It's really quite a special piece of music.
I think the extraordinary thing about it, too, is the way he gets that forward momentum by sort of oom-pa.
Yes.
It's the second beat, the offbeat, is accented.
Yes.
And that makes it very danceable.
Well, you see, you can tell us all about it. Technically, I can't. All I know is that it's just so powerful. But it takes you on this different journey through sort of light and shade and darkness.
But that contrast is so important in everything in life, isn't it? The light only becomes bright if it's put next to dark.
Absolutely. I've learned that as I've got older in life, that, you know, when you're doing anything, even if it's in my world in broadcasting or TV, or film work or whatever, there always has to be light and shade in everything.
Tell us a little bit about your early life, Annabel Croft. You were brought up in Kent.
I grew up in Farnborough in Kent, and I went to school in Sevenoaks. I'm one of three children. I sit right in the middle, but I picked up a racket at the age of nine when we were on a family holiday. And as I said, I was doing ballet at the time. I loved riding. I was very much an outdoor girl. I used to play with the local kids in our road. And back then, my brother had a moped, I think, and we were sort of driving these mopeds around fields and making camps. And I just loved being outside and being very active. I think I exhausted all my friends, but I wasn't interested in schoolwork at all. I just wanted to be out there.
And what about music in your early life? Was it there in the family?
Yes, I used to spend a lot of time with my dad in the car going from Kent, can you believe it, all the way up to London to find indoor courts or training facilities. So quite often he was dropping me off at national training and things like that, but he always listened to classical music in the car. So I loved that. And I think he played the trombone. He loved any kind of musical instruments. My parents both loved music, actually. And I suppose music came into my life through ballet. And then I did start playing the piano when I was at school. I must have been about 9 or 10. And I took a few exams and I loved my piano, but I think it used to drive my brother mad, because we'd be in the playroom and he'd be trying to watch, I don't know, Doctor Who or something, and he'd come across and try to put the lid down on my fingers because me playing the piano was driving him mad.
But your parents were obviously encouraging in terms of playing and...
Yes, very much so. I really wish I had had more music in my life, actually. I sort of, kind of, when I stopped ballet and went into more tennis and then was travelling around, I definitely used to listen to music on, the old Sony Walkmans kind of thing. But
I noticed that a lot of players, as they come onto the court, are listening to music, because I suppose it gets them in the right place.
Yes, most players actually tend to walk onto court with those headsets on and they choose pieces of music. I mean, some of them would be listening to heavy rock music or whatever. I don't know what their kind of mood they're getting themselves into to go and do combat and battle. But I think music can be very powerful to get you in the right frame of mind, can't it?
So, well, it is an arrival that we're going to next.
Oh, yes. Well, there is a bit of a story behind this piece of music, because I did a few exams in my piano. I think I went up to grade 3 or something. And then when I was at my second school, which was West Heath, I did this duet with a girl at school. I think her name was Melanie. And we were then put into a little exam, and I can clearly remember the room that we were in and about 3 or 4 examiners sitting there listening to it. And she was a lovely girl, and we'd practiced it so hard. But I was someone who suffered from nerves terribly. And that wasn't just in tennis, it was generally in anything. So I played the whole thing like Les Dawson, slightly one key out. And all I can remember was my friend looking at me playing her part, like, what on earth are you playing? Because the whole thing was slightly off. So I was so embarrassed, because I carried on and my fingers were doing the job, but they were like Les Dawson in that very famous skit. And I remember looking at the examiners, who looked utterly shocked at what I was playing, but I just bowed at the end and walked out. Don't think I ever took an exam after that.
You should have said, I like a very contemporary take on this.
I should have done. At least I can laugh about it now. I just felt very sorry for my partner, who, you know, she'd put much work into it, and I think I ruined the whole piece.
Musical doubles with one partner failing.
Mixed troubles.
It's the arrival of the Queen of Sheba, of course, and it's a great piece.
Yes, it is. So now we're going to hear it properly.
The Arrival of the Queen of Sheba by Handel, performed by Il Giardino Armonico, conducted by Giovanni Antonini. Well, as we've heard, Annabelle, you're quite an active child, enjoying ballet, and even, I think, performed demonstrations at the Royal Academy.
I did. My goodness, you've done your homework on me. It was just a one-off. I had a very, very good ballet teacher when I was so young, and she put me forward to do a demonstration at the Royal Academy. Again, it's funny how you can remember being in a room, what it felt like. I can remember the preparation, and obviously ballet is very precise, isn't it? You have to have everything perfect in terms of your bun and your hair and your outfit and your shoes and obviously the work that you do. I was very, very young. I would have been probably about 9 or 10, I think. But then I had to make choices after that, whether I wanted to play tennis or do ballet, and I chose tennis.
How did tennis come into your life then?
Well, it was on this family holiday. I picked up a racket for the first time at this hotel. They were just doing little tennis lessons as a group. And I had a wonderful coach. He had a great sense of humour and he was just fun. And I always think humour is so important in life generally, but also certainly for kids to enjoy a subject.
Well, it's light and shade again, isn't
it? Absolutely, it really is. So if you can laugh and have fun in what you're doing, then you're going to enjoy that subject. But, you know, he was a terrific coach, very good fun. And I came back from the holiday and I just wanted to play. I wanted to keep going. So my mum found a local tennis club in Kent. And again, I then went off for these group lessons, and I can distinctly remember having 50p in my pocket for the lesson. That's how much the lesson was back then. And again, the coach, she was called Anthea Warwick, and she had a great sense of humour, and I just couldn't wait to get to lessons every day. So tennis sort of went from there, really, and I never stopped. It was like a big snowball that sort of started rolling, and I never, you know, it just got bigger and bigger.
You clearly had good coordination, though. I mean, dance and tennis, and that's a great start, isn't it?
You're right. I think the ballet probably helped me enormously with the footwork and being coordinated with tennis. It's so good for children to do that kind of thing when they're young, because it connects things up, doesn't it, in the brain, which then enables you to be able to find your way with learning. And I felt like if somebody could show me something, I could then mimic and copy quicker.
At 12, you entered a national championship. How did that go?
Well, that was the first time that life took off in a very different direction. I unexpectedly won the nationals age 12. I wasn't very known or expected to. I hadn't played that many tournaments. And we were down at Eastbourne at Devonshire Park. It was then on grass. And I won that national tournament. And then from that moment, a letter came through the post from the Lawn Tennis Association inviting me for national training. And it just sort of snowballed. I never really had time to stop and think about whether this is what I wanted to do. It was like all too exciting. And then pretty much every weekend was either spent at national training doing sort of 6-hour days at a place called Bisham Abbey, or I was getting on a plane or a train or a boat and going internationally to represent my country, you know, against France, Sweden, Germany, Holland. So you can imagine at that age, it's all very exciting, isn't it? You're doing things that your schoolmates aren't doing, and so hard to say no.
You didn't feel you were missing out on anything, leaving home, school friends?
Yeah, I definitely did feel I was missing out, but it didn't bother me in the slightest. I remember enjoying being slightly different and thinking, I'm prepared to dedicate myself to this, because I suddenly had this drive and this ambition. And I'm a great believer, I'm sure you're the same as me, that you listen to your instinct and your instinct tells you a lot. And I was just following my instinct. Even though I wasn't going to parties, I certainly wasn't having a normal childhood by any stretch of the imagination. And I found lots of diaries that I'd kept from when I was about 9 or 10 of different opponents, strengths and weaknesses. And I was looking back and reading them the other day, and it was quite strange. I thought, gosh, I was really disciplined as such a young child. And weirdly, I found an essay which I wrote when I was 11, and I had laid out as an 11-year-old child that I wanted to play at Wimbledon, I wanted to win a cup there, I wanted to travel around the world playing tournaments internationally, but I also wanted to dance on stage. And I read it the other day and I was like, that is extraordinary. I had no idea I had that much vision for what ultimately I ended up doing. It was quite weird, but you know, it just shows if you're a, you know, child that has discipline and you find something that you're passionate about, it's so important. I want every child to have that.
Mm. Gymnopédie by Satie next.
Yeah, this is another piece of music. Funny enough, back in those days, adverts had very strong pieces of music connected to them, didn't they? And I think this was a very famous chocolate advert. And I always remember my dad going on and on about this piece of music and how much he loved it. And I loved it too. And then my piano teacher then sort of said, oh, I'm going to get you that piece of music and you can play it. And I didn't think I could possibly play it. I could only play the first few bars. But I used to go into the playroom and just practice it and practice it and practice it. And I just couldn't stop playing it. I always got a bit caught on certain sections in. But, you know, if I applied myself, I could sometimes get my fingers to work around it. I'm sure you could play it standing on your head.
I'd rather Anne Kefalek played it.
Okay.
And here she is.
OK. Thank you. That's very beautiful, isn't it? Yeah. It's very gentle and soft, and there's a lot of feeling and movement. I can imagine, you know, movement to it as well. It's just very beautiful.
We heard the first Gymnopédie for piano by Erik Satie, performed by Anne Kefalek. Annabel, at 15, you became the youngest player to play in the Wimbledon main draw in nearly 100 years. Mm. Do you remember that time
very well? I do remember it very well. I remember being in my parents' sitting room when the entry form to apply to take up the wild card at Wimbledon came in, and filling it in and thinking, oh my goodness, everything that I've ever done, training every day for hours and after school, was for this moment to be able to play at Wimbledon, which was my dream. And I'd sat in the stands from age 11 because my uncle was going to Wimbledon in the semi-finals when Virginia Wade was playing. And it was the year that she won. It was in 1977, and the guests that he was taking couldn't go. And he knew I liked tennis, so he'd invited me along. And when I'd sat in the stands at the very top of Wimbledon on centre court and watched Virginia Wade playing Chris Evert, I thought, I want to play at Wimbledon one day. So when I finally made it, it was a dream come true.
And then winning?
Well, I didn't win the main event, but I won in the juniors at 17. And actually, it was the same year I ended up playing Chris Evert myself on court one. And it's funny how I look back now, and because I'm in the trophy cabinet, and when I take guests to the club, you know, I can see that little trophy in there, and I'm on there, you know, forever, I suppose. But it is a very proud moment, and I was presented with the cup in the royal box by the late Duchess of Kent. Yeah. Sadly, she's just recently passed away, but I have such a strong memory of that.
What were your strengths? I mean, serve or...?
Forehand. I was known for having a very big forehand. Yeah. It was my weapon. And I had a bit of a vicious, I like to say, a vicious slice backhand. It wasn't a good backhand in terms of topspin, but I had a single-handed backhand, which I think held me back a little bit. Now the game has moved much towards double-handed, which makes you more stronger on the return of serve. But in terms of like connecting it to music, in tennis there's so many elements. Like you've just said, it could be serve, forehand, backhand, slices, drop shots, volleys. But if you have variety, it's really important. And I imagine in music there are musicians who have that ability to have so much more variety. Is that right?
Yes, but it all comes down to something which I'm sure you would agree with is a good technique to start off with.
That's right, yes. And I think when I look back at my own career, there were frailties in my technique on my topspin backhand, which then got hammered by the pro players on the tour. So that was not easy to deal with, but really my strengths were in my big forehand.
Did you continue to have nerves, as you were talking about earlier?
I did. And it was something that I found very difficult to shake off. And tennis players, and I, even as a broadcaster, I recognise it immediately when I see it in players out there. I can spot, because we're experts in body language, so you can see where there's a tightening of the muscles around shots and they're not able to release and free.
It's fascinating, both in tennis, I think, and in performing music, that if you are relaxed and you're doing well, actually that often means being on the winning side in tennis, which I'm not always, then somehow you play better. And when things start to go wrong, there's quite a dive very often because you haven't got confidence, so you tighten up.
Tighten up. Does that happen in playing music? Do you get tight?
Yes,
so it's the same. It's exactly the same. So in tennis, your arm gets tight, you have adrenaline going through, even your legs stop working quickly and you don't use your feet, you stop running quickly, everything kind of comes to a grinding halt. And on serve, you can imagine trying to throw the ball up straight, it starts to get jerky motion and you can't throw the ball up. So nerves can affect you in so many ways. And it's my biggest regret, really, when I look back on my tennis career, that I really suffered a lot from nerves. And I wish I had had techniques to be able to overcome that. But obviously now in professional sport, you have all these different sports psychologists. And I think there's a lot more knowledge of it all.
But it is fascinating how the great players know how to come back from being in that trough.
Yes.
And they somehow find a way.
Yes. And that is another lesson in life, isn't it? That when things are tough, it's where you have to dig a little bit deeper to find ways to get through it.
Did your success at Wimbledon mean there was quite a lot of media attention on you?
Yes, there was. In fact, once the media hype started, I feel like it never left. And I was quite a shy child and I really didn't enjoy it. And I much preferred playing tennis in America or Australia or Japan or wherever I was, where I was away from from like very high profile here in Great Britain. But it was something I've sort of learnt to live with. And, you know, as you get older, you put it in perspective. And I always think as long as you keep your feet firmly planted on the ground, you'll be absolutely fine. And if you're supported by good people around you.
Well, you put your feet in Houston in Texas,
didn't you?
Escape the spotlight.
I did. My coach was over there. He was actually Australian, but he lived in Houston, Owen Davidson, who had been a great player himself. He'd reached the semi-finals of Wimbledon. He'd won all of the mixed doubles with Billie Jean King. He had a great insight into tactics, techniques. And I spent hours and hours in the 80% humidity. It was so hot. I used to feel sick and dizzy every day training. But of course, that was very good preparation to go and play matches in very hot climates. And I realised, well, how could I possibly do this as a British player in windy, wet Kent, you know, in the winter and then try and play a tournament in Florida? It wasn't going to work. But I made a lot of progress, and Billie Jean King would stop by and offer tips and advice. It was a very happy memory.
In 1985, you won quite a significant women's title, defeating Wendy Turnbull.
Yes, thank you for remembering that. Wendy Turnbull, I think, was about four in the world at the time. And it came at the end of a period of losses. And it's almost like I'd reached rock bottom. I had just lost all of my confidence and I just didn't know where to go. And then suddenly there was a freeing of my spirit. It was like, well, it can't get any worse. So let's just go into this tournament with like another roll of the dice. Came back from, I think, match points down in one of the matches. And it just sort of sparked and ignited some confidence again. And I just carried on winning. And I was there on my own. Can you imagine? I was like 17, I think. And I went right through the entire draw and then ended up beating Wendy Turnbull in the final. And you'll find this quite amusing. At the end of it, I won the trophy and I got this phone call from Berry Gordy. The founder of Motown contacted me and said, would I like to have breakfast? So, of course, I said yes.
What was he like?
He was absolutely wonderful, actually. I just remember it was a room full of lots of assistants and very glamorous people. And he was just wanting to ask me lots of questions about tennis. And he was utterly charming. I mean, I just remember that it was the most enormous spread. It was like pancakes and bacon and whatever eggs I wanted and juices and teas and coffees. And I was so nervous. I couldn't eat anything, but I wished I had.
After taking part in the US and French Open, you retired from professional tennis in 1988. You were then 21. Yeah. Just tell me a little bit about your thoughts at that time and how you came to that decision.
I think I was in quite a difficult place emotionally at that time. And I'd been questioning a lot of things for a couple of years, actually. And I think what it was I'd been on the tour, as you mentioned, since I was 15. And suddenly the reality of what the lifestyle was, which was basically like a travelling circus. You never spent any time at home. And it was relatively lonely. If I didn't have my coach there, because you couldn't afford to take a coach every single week, I'd often be sitting in travel lodges, going for a meal on your own with a book or some sewing. I used to do cross-stitch in those days. And I just thought, gosh, is this the life I've chosen? I knew I wanted to get married and have children, and I really enjoyed the travelling. I enjoyed meeting people. But I think I decided I didn't want to live my life in combat and in a competitive nature until I was mid-30. I thought, I feel like I've done it. And I took a bit of a brave decision to say, you know what, I really feel like my heart's, I'm going in the wrong direction. And I didn't have an education. I didn't know what I was going to do. But I just knew I didn't really want to get out there and keep competing. But I never fell out of love with tennis.
Have you, in retrospect, ever thought, what if?
I do. Of course I do. I look back and I think, gosh, if only I could have had the attitude I have now. Had I been a bit more mature in what I was doing, I would have understood it a little bit better and not taken it to heart so much, the losses. Because for tennis, happiness depended on winning. So it was very hard to find happiness if you're going to lose every week. You're never going to win every tournament you enter. I would love to have, sought more information on the psychology of tennis, on fitness, on nutrition. And I think I would have ended up in a very different place, actually.
Beethoven next. And yes. This, I think, connects you to your love of the outdoors.
Yes, very much so. I'm a complete fanatic about nature. I live very close to Richmond Park, which is my sanctuary. And my husband and I spent many, many days, pretty much every day, either running in the park or walking in the park. And I still do that. And every time I'm in there, it smells different. I love the deer. I love watching them. They're so passionate. And, you know, they've got so much going on in there. It depends what season you're in. If it's rutting season, it's quite dramatic. And it's like watching a film. It's quite incredible. I sometimes just sit on a bench and watch them. I hear different birds and I watch all the kestrels or herons. And I need nature in my life. I think it keeps you very sane. I think everybody needs it.
Thank you.
The first movement of Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony, performed by the Malmö Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Robert Trevino, has a kind of lilting feel.
Yes, it's funny, when I first started listening to that piece of music, I just pictured greenery and, you know, when I walk into the park sometimes, believe it or not, it feels like I'm in Africa. You know, it has this sort of feel about it. But listening to that, I can just kind of see open spaces and open sky and just beautiful scenery.
Many athletes, when they step away from their sport, can feel a degree of a loss of identity. But
yeah,
you found a way to get
over. It's a very good point.
That.
I think a lot of athletes do, and actually a lot of ex-tennis players have come up to me to ask me how I made that transition. You know, I didn't really have time to think. All I knew was that I definitely needed to change direction, and I just kept following my instinct. And I just made lists of people I needed to contact, and then suddenly started getting things going. And I knew I wanted to go into more broadcasting. But of course, in those days, we didn't have dedicated sports channels. There were only like four channels. So it took me a while to get going in commentary. But I kind of experimented. I did a bit of theatre and pantomimes, and I did all sorts. I mean, I literally walked through every door that opened, and I had a go at everything. And I think it was an important time for me to experiment.
What do you think is the key to being a good commentator? I notice even now you're making notes and lists and analysing what might be coming next.
Yes.
And while you listen to the music, putting down your thoughts. Do you watch players' body language?
I do. You cannot not watch your opponent's body language. It's everything. It's telling you so much. I mean, you would play somebody and they've either got a personality that literally can't cope if it's not going their way, and you start to feed off the energy of what's happening down the other end of the court. So you know that if your tactics are working and they're having a meltdown down the other end, you're going to gain from that because you can keep doing it. My feeling was always to try not to show my opponent what was going on. Of course, you're not always going to be able to do that, but definitely, as I commentate, I'm always watching body language. I'm always watching tightness in their arms or legs. I'm watching smoothness, but also you're understanding that a bit of their personality comes into the way that they play. So if you think about a Roger Federer, he's the most laid-back tennis player that you could possibly imagine. So everything is very flowing and floaty and very balletic. But then you could get kind of more of a warrior-type tennis player like a Rafa Nadal, who's more kind of muscles and strength and spins. And this is what makes the contrast so interesting. And it's very gladiatorial. So when people watch tennis, they're picking their gladiator. Aren't they?
Yes, I don't think, like to think what you'd make of my body language.
Yeah, I'd like to know, actually. I probably would sum it up quite quickly if I was able to see you play.
Yes, a couple of words would do, I think. Is it important, do you think, for a commentator to have had the experience of playing?
I think that's why in commentary you have two roles, what we call the lead broadcaster, who sets the scene, brings in all the data and the stats and information. And then I would be called a colour commentator, who's usually someone that's played the game and then can bring in more tactical information, talk over the replays of what's happening, why a shot was missed, do they need to bend their knees more or release more with the racket head? You know, you can bring in more technical knowledge, but I don't think you necessarily need to have played to understand what's going on. I mean, I think that's why tennis is such a great spectator sport, because there are so many pressure moments. You can sense everything that's going on in a player's mind just by watching.
I think it was while you were doing a television show that you met your husband, Mel Coleman.
Well, Mel was an America's Cup yachtsman, and he had had a very similar life to me in that he had been sailing all around the world. And retrospectively, we found out that he'd been in Florida at exactly the same time that I'd been playing tennis, but we'd never met. And he was a very free spirit. You know, he loved being with the elements, and sailing is all about the wind and reading the waves and very, very at one with nature, actually. But we met making a programme about sailing. It was called Cudmore's Call. It was a BBC programme which was teaching three bods. I didn't know anything about sailing. I'd never really been on a sailing boat before. But anyway, we spent this week in Guernsey. I met Mel. And the rest is history. We just never left each other's side from that moment. But I think meeting Mel made me realise there was a life outside tennis. And he was so much fun. He had a great sense of humour. And he kind of taught me about life, actually, because having been a tennis player on the tour, you lose track of normality. I had not had a normal life. So Mel was saying to me things like, Do you understand what a salary is, or do you understand what the price of milk is, and do you understand what university students do? And, you know, he was actually weirdly teaching me an awful lot about normal things.
Catching up.
I was.
You got married in 1993, and I think the music we're going to hear next will bring that back to your mind.
Yes, and this was what I walked down the aisle to, and I just remember crying all the way down the aisle because it was such a significant moment when my dad walked me down the aisle thinking, wow, this is really quite a moment that you're being handed across. And also my grandmother had passed away not so long before, and I had this vision of, you know, she told me what she wanted to wear at our wedding, and of course there was a space there that she wasn't there, so I was a bit emotional walking down the aisle, but this was a very beautiful piece of music. I love that. That also transported me to Melbourne, Australia, actually, because obviously it's such an important piece of music for me walking down the aisle to that. But also when I was at the Australian Open in January this year, I was out walking in the city and I came to a square and these two beautiful violinists started playing this, and it literally brought tears to my eyes because they played it so beautifully.
We heard the Pachelbel Canon and Jig in D major for three violins and continuo, performed by Les Violons du Roi and conducted by Bernard Labadie. Annabel, you and Mel had three children together, but in early 2023, he started feeling unwell.
Yeah, it was a horrific, and it still continues to be a horrific period of time, something that just came so unexpectedly out of the blue. You know, we were making the bed one day and Mel just said to me, "Oh, I haven't told you, I've got these pains in my side." And he said, "But they're not going away, they're getting worse." And I was due to go up to Manchester to the BBC to do some commentary work, and I was going to be away for 2 weeks. And, you know, I don't really like going to doctors lots, and, you know, I just try and stay away from that as much as possible. But I did say to Mel, "Look, you need to go and get some tests done." You know, I just thought originally it must have been indigestion, but it felt like it was more than that. So he went on his own, which now, even to this day, it makes me upset that he went and did those tests on his own. And he had scans, and then he wasn't eating a lot for that whole 2 week period that I was away, and he was being sick and not feeling very well. And he insisted on coming back up to Manchester 2 weeks later to pick me up. And I said, "Look, you're not well, I'll just get on a train and come home." And he said, no, I really want to come pick you up. I love driving, I love being in the car with you." So he came all the way up to pick me up, and they had had the results of the scan, but they hadn't been able to get hold of him. But on the Monday when we got back, we went to see the surgeon, and we'd been told we needed to go and see a surgeon. And he'd said to me in the car park, "I'm a bit worried about this meeting." And I said, no, it'll be fine. They've probably just found a little cyst or something and might need a small operation. But of course, we received the fateful news, which is everybody's worst nightmare, that you stand there and the first thing out of the medic's mouth is, "I'm afraid your life expectancy is not very good. You know, you're basically going to die." And we were in shock, and we all as a family continue to be in shock, because Mel died 3.5 months later, which is quite shocking. I mean, it's still, even as I say it to you, I find it hard to believe I'm saying it, because you can't believe that that's possible, that someone goes from being a healthy, normal, living a normal existence to 3.5 months later dying. But yeah, it's a tragedy, and I feel like he and us as a family have been robbed of 30 years, mm-hmm. at least.
It probably is important to be able to say it, isn't it?
Yes, I think so.
It's part of coming to terms with it.
Yes, I mean, I talk about him very openly, just because, you know, you never not want to talk about somebody just because they've died. But am I always sad when people don't know him? It's hard when you're trying to come to terms with the physical presence and the character not being there. It's... yeah, I suppose I never knew anything about death. And now I identify so much more with people who've gone through it, or people who are suffering from grief. You sort of think, gosh, I had no idea about it, but now I know a lot about it.
He left some rather heartbreaking final instructions for you, didn't he?
He did. While he was dying, he suddenly started listing things. And that was the first time that we knew that he knew he was leaving us. So he started saying to my children, "Oh, I'm sorry, I can't be there for the weddings and I can't walk you down the aisle." And he gave permission to my youngest daughter, Lily's boyfriend. They've just got engaged, actually. And Felix told me the other day that that was one of the things Mel said to him. "You definitely have my permission to marry Lily if you want to." So he started listing lots of things, and he started even saying things like, "Oh, make sure you change the wheel on the van," which was incredible because he was like thinking about our safety, knowing that there was a dodgy wheel on the camper van that he'd converted. And it said so much about him as a man, that he was that caring and that thoughtful about others as he was dying. So it was absolutely heartbreaking, but it all happened so fast. And of course, when he'd gone to hospital that afternoon and he died the next morning, and we'd been up all through the night as things were unfolding so quickly. But I'd never envisaged that when he went to hospital in the ambulance that day, that he wasn't going to ever come back to our house, which he built, or go up that staircase again to our bedroom. You know, all the things that you sort of subsequently think about, and you think, gosh, you're never going to be back here. And he didn't know that either. We thought we were going to hospital to make things better. And yeah, it's just, you know, you can't change it, can you? You can't take it back.
Well, as if to underline the speed of this tragedy, we just heard the Packle Bell from your wedding, and now we're going to hear a piece played at his memorial service.
Yes. I just thought it was a very comforting piece, and the words are very comforting, and it's very sort of hauntingly beautiful. It's just a very every time I hear it, it's very emotional.
Well, that was profoundly affecting.
It was really very emotional, wasn't it? It's hard for me to listen to it without getting quite emotional, but it's still very beautiful. And I mean, I don't know what to say. It's just such a powerful piece of music, isn't it?
The Lord Bless You and Keep You, performed by the Cambridge Singers, composed and conducted by John Rutter. And of course, Annabel, you had three children together, which is both a wonderful thing for the future, but also you had to support them.
Yes, but in actual fact, I feel like my children have been more of a support to me than probably I was to them, to be honest. They showed me support, which was just extraordinary, and they still do. Like, you know, they call me every day, or they make sure I'm okay in the evenings, and have I got somebody to have dinner with, or they invite me over. So all my friends have been like that, but my children particularly have just showed such great strength of character, and I couldn't feel more supported. Yeah, I guess along this awful journey that we've been on, having lost Mel, I keep being reminded all the time that I have to think about the 36 years we had together rather than focus on what we didn't have at the last chapter that we were looking forward to together. I sort of feel like I do keep reminding myself some people never had what we had. So it's wonderful to have that. And we do have three wonderful grown-up children who, yeah, are what he's left behind.
Do you have a sort of personal faith, and was that of any help if you do?
I've always been somebody who used to say my prayers, and I was probably more religious in my earlier days and then very open-minded. I always used to think, well, nature is my religion. But it's funny how, you know, when you lose somebody, well, he's my rock and my anchor, you know, my everything, I guess it makes you think much more about where did he go? What is it? We'll all find out one day. But, yeah, I guess it makes me think a little bit more deeply about all these things.
Later that year, the BBC asked you to take part in Strictly Come Dancing. What made you say yes?
What made me say yes was that Mel loved the show so much and always had wanted me to do it, but I'd never been invited. And I have such strong visuals of Mel being in our kitchen watching it and calling us to the screen to watch Johannes, who I ended up dancing with. And I also was in such grief. You know, the idea of being distracted was just amazing. And it really was. I mean, I still think, gosh, how fortunate was I to be asked to do that wonderful programme and to be dancing every day. I think music is and dance is so amazing to get grief out of you. And also I was worried about going back to this empty house, which had been so filled with his presence before. And sort of in that period of time, you know, September, October, November, December, the nights draw in, don't they? And I kept thinking, gosh, going back to that house, you know, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's just going to be quiet without him there. The idea of being out dancing all day just seemed like a much better idea than just wallowing in my grief.
I think Johannes had some misgivings because he'd been through bereavement, hadn't he?
Yes, he absolutely had. And he told me that the first time we met. And he said very clearly, I understand what you're going through. And we just connected in a very powerful way. And I still have an absolute love for him. And we speak regularly. And we had a shared experience together in that show. I mean, it was a lot of highs and lows and emotion and a lot of fun. I mean, I look back and it's utterly terrifying programme to do. I mean, my heart was just racing every single time I had to dance live on that Saturday night. And I was quite worried about what I was doing to him because, you know, I never knew quite what my body was going to do and whether it would remember the steps and everything. But weirdly, it took me back to my tennis days. So there was this crossover between, oh, my goodness, you know, I had this fear of going out into big stadiums playing tennis and now I've put myself back there in the dancing. But it was good to revisit those emotions as a much older person.
And realise those early childhood dreams, really, of dancing.
Yeah, that's right. I'd laid it out as that 11-year-old in my essay about what I wanted to do in life.
Well, we can relive it now because the next music is the Paso Doble, which I think you danced.
Yes.
And you got 10 from the judges when you danced it.
I know, I couldn't believe it. I think they were a bit generous, but it was wonderful to do I never thought I could do a Paso Doble. I wouldn't have even known what that was before I took part in the show, but I know what it is now and I loved every second of it.
What do you most remember about learning this piece?
We had a lot of fun in the rehearsals and he wasn't quite sure how to start the dance. And at one stage, he was going to drag me across the floor. And I said, what am I? Am I an injured bull or what am I? And then I dragged him and we were having so much fun in trying to work out how to start the dance. And in the end, he said, no, you're going to charge at me and I'm going to catch you. So the dance starts with this very dramatic opening scene where I literally run at full belt. And I was so worried that, you know, what I mean, I'm going to injure you if I run at you and launch myself into your arms. But it is quite a dramatic start. And it was very intricate, the steps, but it was the first time I actually felt like I was just letting go. And at the end, I was literally gasping for air on the floor as he sort of flung me on the floor at the dramatic ending. But I remember the sort of standing ovation in the studio that we got afterwards, and it was just incredible.
Thank you. Hispana Carne, composed by Pasquale Martina and performed by the Cincinnati Pops Orchestra, conducted by Eric Kunzel. You came fourth.
I did, and even listening back to that, I could picture myself in every part of that dance, and I loved it.
You've described Strictly, Annabelle, as the most life-changing and extraordinary experience of my life, but after it had finished, like after tennis, was it hard to return to normal life?
That's a really good question, because I think it is. I think it's hard for anyone who's done Strictly to kind of return to normal, because you're in this bubble. Even now, I sort of think, gosh, as I go towards older life, I would like to just find somewhere I could live near a studio and dance all day, because it is so freeing of the spirit and it's connected so strongly to music. And I can't think of anything I'd rather be doing, to be honest with you.
And it must have been a wonderful distraction at that time, given what you were going through.
Yeah, it really was the most incredible distraction. It was a very emotional period of time, and there was a lot of tears every day, but it helped me enormously, and I'm very, very grateful for that.
You're about to go on a speaking tour around the UK, and that must be quite cathartic too.
Yeah, I was given this opportunity to do a speaking tour, and at first I was a bit apprehensive, and then I thought, actually, why not? You know, it's easy to say no to things, but actually my whole life I've always kind of walked through doorways that presented themselves and were opportunities. And I thought, again, it's a little bit like Strictly. It would be fun to go around to these intimate settings and theatres, you know, have a good old chat about life and my experiences. And then obviously with grief and health and having a good old chat, and I am going to dance again. So the gentleman that's with me is a lovely ballroom dancer called James Cutler. So we're going to do it together, and he's going to guide me in the two dances that we're going to do on the tour.
Tell us about your next piece, Annabelle. It's from a film, Gabriel Sobert.
This is beautiful. And actually, I chose this piece because I've always loved it, but my son got married very, very recently to beautiful Honor. They've been together for many years, and she walked down the aisle to this piece of music, and it was played live. It created such emotion. I mean, I always find it very difficult when I'm in a church and you see a beautiful bride walking down the aisle, but when you hear a piece of music played so beautifully live, it's impossible not to feel emotion.
We both looked at each other at that little decoration.
Yes, the decoration.
Da, 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 da,
yes, that's
which
the bit
kind
I like.
Of gets into the brain.
Yes, it does. It gets into my body. When there are certain pieces of music that get what I call inside me, and then you just feel it through your whole body, and my body often reacts to music. And, yeah, I really love that.
Gabriel Zobo from the film soundtrack of The Mission, composed by Ennio Morricone. Annabel Croft, you've interviewed legends like Novak Djokovic, Rafa Nadal and Roger Federer, but I wonder which tennis player has been really your favourite to watch on court?
I think it has to be Roger Federer. Mm. I picked up a racket to begin with because of Bjorn Borg. I always loved him and I was such a huge fan of his. But in terms of the purity and the balletic artistry that Federer was as a tennis player, I'm not sure we'll ever see anyone quite like him. He really had such an incredible rare talent, and it was the way he moved so fluidly, the effortless style, it just seemingly impossible shots that he would just a flick of the wrist and an outrageous winner. I think he even surprised himself.
How would you say that tennis has changed since the day when you were playing?
I think ultimately what the sport is has not changed. It's gladiatorial. You put yourself up against somebody else. It's who's going to come out on top, you know, that which ego is going to win. But in terms of, obviously, the financial side of things has gone extortionate since my playing days. I mean, what was it? US Open champion just got $5 million, I think it was, which is unbelievable. And I think the teams around the players are more like Formula One teams now. So they travel more as a big team. And of course, with those kind of finances, if you're winning and you're at the top of the sport, then you can afford all that big team. And obviously, social media has come into the world. Whatever people think about it, I think sometimes for these players, it's hard for them to be reading all the comments and, you know, all the stuff that goes along with that. So that's changed a lot. There's more knowledge in the fitness side, the nutrition, but what the sport is, pitting yourself against somebody else, that's never changed, and the pressure has never changed.
The life of a young tennis star is in many ways like that of a young classical soloist. Lots of travel, hotel rooms, having to perform on demand at the highest level. So the pressure on young players is greater than ever, isn't it?
It is, and I recognise that a lot, and I think more players are talking openly about feeling unhappy on the tour. Many more, actually. And I think they're all trying to figure out how they can make this journey more enjoyable along the way. They'll have all picked up a racket very young, even younger than I was. They would have picked up a racket probably 4 or 5. And now they're going down this journey. Happiness depends on winning. And you're not going to win every tournament or every match every day. So a lot of players are real perfectionists and they take it very much on board when they're losing. We all need grounding. And I would say your wealth is in your friendships.
What are you going to serve us with your final track?
Well, this is a really beautiful piece of music, which I know we've picked some very emotive pieces, and I'm afraid this is another one, but this was sung at my wedding by a very great friend I was at school with, Izzy Van Randwick. And when we were trying to choose music at Mel's memorial, I just thought about it and I got it out and I thought, oh my goodness, this is so beautiful and the words are so beautiful. And so I chose it again.
It's Make Me a Channel of Your Peace, composed by Sebastian Temple and performed by the Westminster Abbey Choir. Annabel Croft, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.